Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. This show is available as a podcast. It's also available on iTunes, and all of the podcasts that you hear here at WFYI are available on Spotify. Now, in a little bit, I'm going to replay my interview with film director Rick Harper. This is the gentleman that made the 2016 documentary Roomful of Spoons about the phenomenon of the film The Room. There's an update with this documentary, which I'll get to in a little bit. But there are two new films, and of course, I will get to your comments as well on Facebook and Twitter of what you've watched recently. But there's a couple new movies that came out digitally that I was able to check out and add them to your list. So I guess this is an early version of Grab a Pencil. Here's a couple titles. One is a film called How to Build a Girl, which stars Beanie Feldstein. This is the one of the young ladies from Booksmart. And she plays young, lowly Johanna at age 16, looking for a storybook boy and being the outcast in her school. But she finds her new sense of belonging and popularity and fame and work becoming a music journalist. So imagine Almost Famous meets Pygmalion. Goes from having and she submits an article to the reviewing the soundtrack to Annie as her audition piece and winds up getting some reviews of some concerts, and that leads to some a bit of a following, and she learns the ups and downs of music journalism. According to this film, every music journalist is a hater, says the film critic, who also wrote for A Dozen Years for Nouveau. Which, by the way, salute SkyPoint to my brothers and sisters at Nouveau. Thank you for my 12 years of work. But anyway, it goes through her ups and downs, and she becomes first a fan and then a hater and then finds a way in between. And the film is anchored by a nice performance from Beanie. If you enjoyed her in Booksmart, this isn't as good a film as Booksmart. It is more of a fantasy world than actually Booksmart. But, there's a fun recurring bits where she talks to the portraits on her wall of her idols, which include folks like Sigmund Freud, who's played by Michael Sheen, Gemma Arterton is Maria von Trapp, Lucy Punch is Sylvia Plath, a couple other familiar famous faces. Chris O'Dowd has a bit part as a host of a TV talent show where Beanie's character goes and recites a poem awkwardly, which leads to school ridicule. Patty Constantine plays her dad. It's a nice up and down story of a young girl finding herself in the world, and finding the ups and downs of music journalism and finding a sense of self. So it's a fun film to check out. Also a streaming courtesy of IFC Midnight is the horror film The Wretched, and it's basically a teen boy whose parents are going through a divorce. He's spending the summer with his dad. And what happens when the hot mom next door is actually a witch sucking the souls out of everybody on the island? This is written and directed by the Pierce brothers. And as I was watching this, it has the prerequisites of horror films in the last 30 years. Well, in the cases like, creepy moments happening via a baby cam, skinny dipping teenagers, husband not noticing that the wife is different, and physical body contortions by those who are possessed. It's When Joker came out, I had a long talk on the show about the difference between an homage and a ripoff. And I think if you like it, it's an homage. If you don't like it, it's a ripoff. And in the case of Joker, it borrowed too much for my taste of Taxi Driver and The King of Comedy. And there's a lot of stuff that you could that I could cite here. And it, but as far as, oh, that's a shot similar. For instance, there's a scene of our teen hero who's pushed up against a door with the camera from the shooting him from the floor, which is like Jack Nicholson being stuck in the meat locker in The Shining. There's a lot of moments like that that just reminds me of it, but it's also a horror film. So you get things like jump cuts and scares. This film has owes a little bit to Fright Night, the original, not the remake, where our hero seems to be the only one noticing things are going wrong, although he does have a girlfriend on the island. And there's also an homage to the girlfriend in question who gets to do a bit straight out of Grace Kelly in Rear Window, same kind of point of view from the second floor window as our hero is watching. So, but it didn't bother me as much. I guess if you're a horror fan, you're used to it and you'll enjoy it. It was okay. It didn't offend me as much as something like Joker, as far as I guess it's more cliches of a genre as opposed to specific films, even though I just cited Fright Night, Rear Window, and The Shining. But and also Invasion of the Body Snatchers, any of the Body Snatcher films where he can trust no one. So, but it's harmless. It didn't bother me as well as other ripoffs. So that is out there as well. And just a reminder, you can stream lots of things and rent lots of, well, you can, if you have Redbox, it's still around. Vin Diesel's new film Bloodshot is out there if you're into that. The Jesus Rolls, if you needed a sequel to the John Turturro character from The Big Lebowski. Of course, IU Cinema is doing virtual tickets, so you can go to cinema.indiana.edu to check out some of the stuff going on there, like the Best of Cat Video Fest and New York International Children's Film Festival, Behind the Visible, things like that. That is happening at IU Cinema. And, of course, as I'm trying to click on here, the Can-Can has stuff going on at their theater as well virtually. So go check those out. All right. Now, a while back, I interviewed Rick Harper, who made the documentary Roomful of Spoons, which was about the phenomenon of The Room and its creator, Tommy Wiseau. And Wiseau was involved with the documentary or gave his blessing until they tried to find out too much about his own background. A lawsuit happened, and a Canadian court, I'm reading this from Variety, a Canadian court has ordered Tommy Wiseau to pay about $700,000 to the makers of an unauthorized biography about his cult film, The Room, ruling that he thwarted the release of the documentary because it was unflattering. We also had The Disaster Artist coming out around that time. So anyway, what's funny is if you go to the Roomful of Spoons website, roomfulofspoons.com, you can read the court case. They've posted everything. So everything from the statement of claim back in June of 2017 to the reasons for judgment on April 23rd. So with that in mind, going to go back into the archives, which is fun to do. Here's my interview with filmmaker Rick Harper about his documentary, Roomful of Spoons. Enjoy. Joining me on Film Sociology is a man who peeked behind the curtain, and it's a documentary called Roomful of Spoons. Of course, as you know, Film Sociology is your home for Tommy Wiseau information, but Rick Harper is here. Rick, how you doing, my friend?
Hey, I'm really good. Thanks a lot for having me, Matt.
I would say, tell us about your first experience of watching the film The Room.
The first time I watched The Room, I actually watched it at home. I was with my wife, and I sat her down and said, all right, we're going to watch the worst movie ever made. So we press play, and I guess my initial thoughts were, this really can't be that bad, because the opening montage of San Francisco is so well shot and edited, and then you have the beautiful score by Mladen Lechevic, and everything seemed fine. I'm like, how bad can this thing really be? And then Tommy walks through the door,
hi, babe,
character Johnny, and says, hi, babe,
yeah,
and everything changed from that moment on.
I believe there's a quote in your film that I can't remember who said it, but the quote, accidental good instincts came into play at times.
Yeah, yeah, that was a quote. I was quoting Sandy Chaclair, actually, when I said that. I thought it was a really interesting way of qualifying Tommy's success?
I was a couple weeks ago, I was watching the film version of Valley of the Dolls, and they were talking about the definition of camp, of something that's played seriously, but it winds up becoming unintentionally funny. And the Room fits that and then some.
It sure does, yeah.
I would say, so how many times did you watch? I'm going to say, when was it when you finally got to see it with an audience?
It was just the next, like, probably a few weeks after I saw it on DVD. I knew that, I did a little research on it, and I knew that people were throwing spoons, and there was call-out lines at the theater, and it was like a big party. So it plays at my local theater here, my local art house theater called the Mayfair. So only a couple weeks later, I went to see it, and it was, like, what an experience. It was so much different. Like, of course, it's fun to watch at home. Watching it in theaters is just a completely different experience. It's not even like a movie. It's more like an event. Every time you go see it, it's different. You know, people shout things at the screen. They throw spoons. They dress up like characters. It's just a huge party.
I say, did your wife make it through the whole film?
She did. She did. She's not quite as big a geek as I am, but she actually sat through it with me. She even came to the Mayfair with me a couple of times, and because of my, I guess you could call it an obsession with the movie, she sort of got into the whole cult phenomenon of it as well.
You're a lucky man. Mine lasted 30 minutes, and she got up and left. And my daughter watched it, but she had to cover her eyes during the four love scenes, which takes up about a third of the film.
Yeah, that's it's not exactly a PG movie, but I don't blame your wife. It's for a special type of person.
Yeah.
The Room isn't necessarily for everyone.
No, she pats me on the head regularly about that. So I was about to say, because I remember, I think it was the Onions AV Club. They talked about the day Midnight Movies died was when Rocky Horror was available on home video. The fact that you could watch anything at any time. And I think the Room single-handedly helped bring back the Midnight Movies. Because since then, there have been films like Miami Connection and Troll 2 and Roar where you have that midnight communal experience, I think single-handedly the Room has been that champion.
Yeah, I would totally agree with you because I was a little bit young when Rocky Horror came out and stuff like that, so I never really got to experience that. But I would hear my uncles and my dad talk about Rocky Horror and going, people dressing up, and it's not something that it was always something that I was kind of fascinated with, but never got to experience. Until The Room came out, and it was this whole new generation of people going to midnight movies and dressing up and the call-out lines and really having a lot of fun with it. And then, of course, movies like, Samurai Cop and Birdemic and stuff like that started resurfacing, and it just sort of revived that whole cult experience.
So how long did it take before you started to do preparation to make the documentary?
About a year. From the first time that I saw it, I was going to see it every single month at the Mayfair, and probably after about a year, the owner of the Mayfair, he always does a little introduction, and he said, I'm thinking of bringing Tommy Wiseau to Ottawa. He's doing a tour. What do you guys think of that? So right after that, I went to see him, and I said, hey, I really want to sponsor the event. At the time, I just really wanted to become a filmmaker, and the owner of the Mayfair, he's a filmmaker himself, so I wanted to sort of get into his circle, and then I figured if I sponsor this event, I get to meet with him, and I get to meet Tommy Wiseau, so it was just really good math to me. So we did that, and I got to meet Tommy, and immediately I knew I had to do something with him. I figured this is my opportunity to sort of hang out with somebody who I really admire and I think is really cool, and pursue my dream of becoming a filmmaker. So I pitched the idea of doing a documentary.
And he was receptive right away?
Initially, yeah. He thought it was a great idea. He's like, yeah, we can do it under Wiseau Films, and I have a red cam, and why don't you guys come next month, have a big event at the Ziegfeld in New York City.
And you'll have a groovy time.
And you have groovy time. Yeah, that's right. So, I was really excited. I'm like, oh, wow, like my dream of becoming a filmmaker is coming true. And, Tommy invited me to New York. So, I assembled a crew and hired a few assistants and went to New York and started shooting the documentary then.
Well, when I talked with Tommy about this, which you can hear a little later on in the show, was, I mean, from a filmmaking standpoint, it's hard to make a movie. It is hard. I mean, there have been thousands of movies that have been attempted and not finished. So the fact that he was able to have a complete product, that's something to be said. That's something that not everybody can do. And, you know, so at the very least, there is that achievement. It's just nobody quite expected what we were getting with his finished film.
Right.
So how many times do you think you saw it before you got to meet Tommy? You said you saw it, we were seeing it almost every week?
Almost every month. So
almost
I would say at
month?
Least
okay.
a dozen times.
Okay.
And I mean, once you really get into it, you're not just watching it in theaters. You're watching clips on YouTube and the memes. So I was living the room for about a year until I actually got to meet him, you know? And yeah, I mean, and a lot of people think that, you know, meeting Tommy is funny and his movie's funny and it's ridiculous and there's bad things. But absolutely, there is something to admire there because, you know, he was a first-time filmmaker, clearly didn't know what he was doing, but no real first-time filmmakers do, you know? Mm-hmm. And just like you said, a lot of people don't even finish their films or they just talk about it or, you know, they might have a script that they started or there's all types of obstacles, of course, money being one. And he was able to fight through all that, and the result wasn't necessarily what he intended it to be, but it's definitely admirable that he was able to finish it and turn it into such a success.
Now, I don't want to give away too much with your documentary, but was it your intent from the get-go to try to, I use the term, peek behind the curtain when it comes to Tommy Wiseau as a person?
Not necessarily, no. Now, of course, there's a lot happened after that trip to New York. Things sort of went awry with Tommy. He wanted to take the documentary in a different direction. Now, you know, while I respect that, and in retrospect, it makes sense to me, but he just wanted to make basically an hour and a half long promotion for The Room.
Right.
Which essentially is what a documentary is. You know, like you are promoting the movie, you're telling people that this movie exists and why it's so special and why it's so, you know, adored. But as soon as I started interviewing certain people that he didn't want me to talk to and stuff like that, he backed away and just basically said that he didn't want to take part in it anymore. It was a bit discouraging initially, but then, you know, like I said, in retrospect, it's a good thing because when you're it would create a real bias if you have, you know, if the person you're documenting is a producer on the project.
Mm-hmm.
So once Tommy bowed out of the project, I decided to take it in a bit of a different direction. We interviewed all of the cast, most of the crew, a lot of people who just worked on The Room peripherally or have other projects that are related to it. And then also then we decided to, you know what, there's a lot of mystery around who Tommy is. So we started doing a little bit of research to find out, to answer some of the questions that fans have been debating over for the past, 13 years now.
Who were the people he didn't want you to talk to?
Early on, I remember a conversation. It was the day before I was leaving to my first time going to L.A. And he told me, he said, I'm not against your project, but he said, don't interview Sandy Chaclair or the blonde guy with the glasses. So I later found out that the blonde guy with the glasses was Michael Rousselet, who's a great guy, and I don't really know why he didn't want me to interview him. Michael Rousselet is the person who more or less discovered The Room. He was one of the original fans. He was the one who brought a lot of people to come see it and made it what it is today, you know. But and then Sandy Chaclair is someone who he had a very public feud with. You know, Sandy claims that he was the real director of The Room and not Tommy. And we touch on that in the documentary as well.
Yep.
And then, of course, you know, I did interview or I reached out to a lot of Tommy's family members, and he didn't like that too much either. But, you know, he was no longer at that point involved in the movie and didn't really have a whole lot of say in the direction I was taking it in. So I think that I dealt with that in a very mature and respectful way. But there are certain things in the movie that that he didn't want me to reveal, and certain people he didn't want me to talk to, and stuff like that.
Yeah, the interviews with Sandy reminded me of William Goldman's claiming that he wrote Good Will Hunting, and it's like there's now a parallel between The Room and Good Will Hunting.
That's an interesting parallel because there's certainly a difference in quality between the two. But yeah, no, Sandy's he's very passionate. I mean, if you can look up Sandy Chaclair's IMDb, he's a very, very accomplished filmmaker. So it's interesting in itself that somebody who's so accomplished and has worked with literally everyone in Hollywood would want to take credit for something that's considered to be the worst movie ever made. So in itself, that makes made for a really interesting interview. But there you have it. You know, he claims that he directed it. And, you know, that he set up every shot, told the actors what to do, and that Tommy did nothing on set except act, really.
And yell things like, don't touch the dialogue, it's genius.
Yeah, and stuff like that, too. He said when he was trying to change some of the words to translate a little bit better onto screen, you know, that he would say, oh, don't touch the dialogue, it's genius, it's meant to be this way, and stuff like that. So he makes fun of the movie a lot and basically claims that while making it, he just thought, you know, no one's ever going to see this, so I'm just going to have fun, and that he sabotaged the movie. How much of that is true is really up for the viewer to decide.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then you obviously talked to a lot of the cast and the crew, and I think of the interviews with Juliet, who is an extremely patient human being. And I know she talked about how it was a job at first, kind of horrifying afterwards, seeing the finished result, and then enough time has passed that she was able to embrace it. Was that the general consensus with most of the cast and crew?
I think so. You know, everyone was really open about participating in this. I didn't really have to convince anyone to take part in it. No one was, you know, really hiding from their quote-unquote fame that they got from being in the room. You know, everyone just sort of really has fun with it. I think that while we make fun of the movie, we as in the fans, while we make fun of the movie, there's something really genuine about it. And I think that a lot of the actors and the people who took part in the movie know that we genuinely like them. Like, they, you know, we go see them, but it's not, we don't make fun of them as a person or as an actor. We're just making fun of this silly project that they were in, you know, 12, 13 years ago. So, you know, while for Juliet especially, because, you know, she spends half the movie naked, and she's one of the actresses who really, you know, took it seriously while making it. So she really thought she was making a good movie and that this was going to be her, this was really going to kick off her career as an actress and stuff like that. So, of course, initially she was really hurt. And she says, you know, during one of the interviews, how she wanted to dig a hole 10 feet deep and just hide until this whole thing blew over. But I think, I think once she realized that this isn't going away, she might as well just embrace it and just accept, you know, the fame that she did get and whatever comes with it. And I think she realizes now that the fans really do love her. And that was an important goal of mine early on, because at some of the screenings, people yell really mean things about her. Not so much anymore, but earlier on, people would, you know, say very shaming things about the way that she looked and, you know, stuff like that. So it was an important goal of mine early on to really humanize her and show the fans, like, look, this is who Juliet Danielle really is. And I feel I was successful in doing that. She's an absolute sweetheart, and she came across that way in the movie.
Again, a really, really good sport, especially her telling the story of watching it for the first time and realizing what stayed on film. I mean, that's extremely harsh. So, a couple other connections. We were talking about parallels of other films, and I remember in some of the ad campaigns that there was somebody had name dropped Tennessee Williams, and the fact that Tommy actually told the composer that he was trying to make A Streetcar Named Desire, or at least his version of it.
Right.
As far as making I use the term melodrama, I guess, in the traditional sense, not in the critical sense. And then another one I know he brought up was trying to make his own version of A Rebel Without a Cause. That's, I think, where the famous catchphrase is based upon.
Yeah.
But he really wanted to make a high drama of a feel from the 1950s.
Yeah, that's it. That's the impression that at least he gave, you know, Mladen Milicevic, the composer, and a lot of how he would, I guess, direct the actors, you know, tell them, like, you need to have passion and it has to be dramatic. And, you know, Greg Sestero was even quoted as saying that, you know, that he said that he was going to make a movie so dramatic that people weren't going to sleep for 2 weeks after seeing it. And stuff like that. And while you can see the passion in some of his acting, I mean, some of the scenes where you can tell he's trying to be really emotional, and that this is, you know, more than likely a very personal story. to him, it just doesn't come across that way because, you know, I guess the quality of his acting and a lot of the directing and the story itself is kind of flawed, and there's just so many things wrong with it that it's hard to take seriously. Had it starred an entirely different cast, had it been directed by a different person, maybe he could have got those emotions across. I think that's a reason that we love it so much, because we can see the effort on camera. Like, we know there's something real there, but he just doesn't succeed in telling that story, as dramatically as he wanted to.
Can you pinpoint when Tommy publicly decided to, now what is now has become his mantra of people take the film for what it is? Do we know when that shift happened?
I think it was immediately after the premiere. Now, the earliest footage of Tommy saying that before a crowd that I have is from 2004 at the one-year anniversary from the release of The Room, where it was already popular amongst fans like Michael Rousselet and his friends and stuff like that. So he would rent small theaters and sell tickets and, you know, give away T-shirts and stuff like that. And there's a small clip in the documentary where he says, you know, he says, keep in mind everything in this documentary was done on purpose. Everything was intentional. And then the crowd sort of chuckles a little bit, because even back then they knew that it's impossible that this was all on purpose. Now, according to, you know, the interviews that I have, I think it was Scott Holmes that said that right after the premiere, so right after, like, the first day that it ever screened, you know, when people were laughing and stuff like that, he went to Greg and said, you know, why are people laughing at my movie and stuff like that? And then Greg told him, oh, it's because your comedic timing is really good. And that possibly, if you ask me, I think that probably sort of a light bulb came above his head, right? And then he just figured, like, oh, okay, let me just market it this way, since people, they laughed and they're obviously not going to take it seriously. So instead of just getting discouraged and burying this project, let me just remarket it and see if people will respond, and he was successful in doing so.
And he and Greg are getting paid for each appearance on college campuses and theater houses ever since.
All over the world, yeah. They've been all over the world together. They tour in so many different cities, and it's wild. Like, I've traveled to all over just while filming Room Full of Spoons. And it's incredible. Everybody knows Tommy. It's just really wild.
I guess I'm going through my notes, and I guess I have to ask, where is your respect, Rick?
Poor Tommy. He doesn't like me right now. While I still do have a tremendous amount of respect for him, we're not seeing eye to eye as far as the documentary is concerned. I think, like, we're in talks right now, and I think we're going to come to sort of an amicable resolution soon. And but he's went online and made statements about him not supporting the documentary and shame on you videos and stuff like that. He has this idea that, you know, that this movie is just completely disrespectful towards him and is bullying him and all these things, these terms that he uses, which was, of course, never my intention. I mean, I think I'm a pretty respectful guy. I can appreciate that if a documentary is being made about someone, that person isn't going to agree with everything that's said, but a lot of that is out of my control. A lot of it is people's opinions, and the rest is, and the research that I've done is all factual. So, you know, I don't know what his specific concerns are, but, I think we're going to come to an amicable resolution very soon.
But have you been contacted by any form of lawyers at all?
I'm sorry, Matt. I don't really think I could talk about that.
It was worth a shot.
I mean, you can take that answer for what it's worth.
Fair,
you know?
No, fair enough. I had to ask. So.
Sorry, man.
No, it's okay. I was going to say, I think one of the scenes that you in the film is, I believe, the largest crowd you saw this with an audience was in Copenhagen.
Yes. Now, I wasn't there to witness that. I did go to Copenhagen, and we did a screening of The Room, and I did go back to screen Room Full of Spoons. But it was the promoter, the Scandinavian promoter, Elias Elliott. He was telling a story about how they screened it in Roskilde, and I hope I pronounced that correctly, and they had to turn away 2,000 people. They sold 850 seats, and they had to turn away 2,000 people, and it was just like the biggest screening of The Room in Europe ever.
Wow. And who created the video game?
That's a gentleman named Tom Falk. He's the CEO of Newgrounds, and they program a lot of video games for the web and for Xbox and stuff like that. And so, yeah, he's a really cool guy. He's actually in Philadelphia. And so we drove down there and interviewed him. Really, really nice guy. He said it took them, I believe, 6 months to make the game. And if you, you know, playing the game is basically like watching a movie. It's every line, but then, of course, there's all this other fun and creative stuff that's in it. And it's a real blast.
Are the love scenes in the video game?
I believe they are. I don't know how graphic they are,
Wow.
But yes, I believe they are. I think everything that's in the room and more is in the game.
There you go, folks. Have it at it. It's your will. So I guess, how has it been promoting the film? How many festivals have you been to so far?
We submitted to a whole lot of festivals. Of course, it's still new. We premiered in Spain at the Cutrecon Festival in January, and that went really well. It was really, really well received. And then we have a couple other festivals that are coming up that I'm not sure I can announce just yet, but they will be announced on our website, roomfulofspoons.com, very soon. And we submitted to a lot of others. We did the premiere in my hometown here in Ottawa, and you know, it was a almost sold out event, and it was again a great success. And we, you know, I did a little bit of touring while I was in Europe after the Spanish premiere. Went to Copenhagen, and we went to the UK and just did just a few test screenings just to see how audience were responding to it and to see if there's some edits that we can make. And the response has been unanimous. Like, people are really, really enjoying it, which is validating for me, because I really made this for the fans. You know, being a big fan of the room and you know, and it has such an important cult following that I wanted to make something that was worthy of its fan base. And so far people are really digging in.
Has it been allowed to be on a double bill with the room?
Not yet. And that's something that I'm working on with Tommy right now, because I feel that it could be, you know, that could be really successful. I think people are going to want to watch Room Full of Spoons more than once. It's, you know, I've been told it's hilarious, which is fun for a documentary, because a lot of times documentaries is just, you know, an overload of information, which is fun in itself, but some of the stories that people tell and stuff, people really crack up, especially in theaters, and you know, so I think that people would really have fun with it, and I think it would play great with the room. So it's my hopes that that's going to eventually work out, that we can double bill it with the room.
Well, I think Room Full of Spoons is the hearts of darkness of the room itself. So you know, you have a good company as far as the making behind.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Do you have another project lined up for once this dies down, or are you just still in the whirl of promoting the film?
We are promoting the film right now, and we have you know, some tours coming up. So I'm going back to Europe in June, and then you know, we're going to Australia in July and stuff like that. And of course, we're going to be touring the U.S. In May and June probably. But we are flirting with some ideas right now, whether that's going to be another documentary or like a scripted film. We're not 100% sure on just yet, but nothing worthy of announcing. But we are, you know, sort of toying with some ideas right now.
And what was your take on the book? And I know they're trying to make a film out of The Disaster Artist.
The book was fantastic. The book It's really the room Bible. Like, I was, I didn't really know what to expect, because a lot of the stories I knew already and stuff like that. But hearing it from Greg's perspective, and if you listen to the audiobook, hearing Greg's impression of Tommy is just, it's absolutely fantastic. So I think the book is genius. You know, as a fan of the room, I almost get a little emotional when I read it, you know, but, and the James Franco project, I mean, I'm really hoping that it's going to be that it's going to translate well onto film. I mean, the audiobook itself is, I think, 11 or 12 hours. So to try to condense all those stories and all those years into an hour and a half film, or however long it's going to be, I really hope that it I hope it's going to be good. I really do. And I think James Franco is the right guy to play Tommy. I think he's going to do a fantastic job. He's a great actor. And and yeah, I guess we'll see. I'm excited for it, though.
Well, fans of The Room, just, I think once it's a very addictive film. Once you've experienced it, you want others to experience it. You want to know as much as you can about it. And I would say, Rick, congratulations on Room Full of Spoons as far as providing that for fans of The Room. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, man. I appreciate that.
Hey, everybody. everyone. This is Tommy Wiseau, and you're listening now to Film Sociology at the WFYI Indianapolis.
Of course, that's Tommy Wiseau. But before that, you heard my interview with Rick Harper, the director of the 2016 documentary Roomful of Spoons. You can go to roomfulofspoons.com for all information about the film and the court case. Congratulations, Rick. All right, this is the grab a pencil portion of the show, folks. Let's hear what you've watched over the last week, and hopefully your titles will inspire somebody else to watch that said film. And I've actually had a couple people send me notes saying that they watched a film title based on me rattling off titles. So thank you, and thank you. So we'll start with my buddy Eric, who's doing this from work. First time viewing, he found Beyond a Reasonable Doubt from 1956 to be good. That's the film with Dana Andrews. And then from 1950, the film called The Next Voice You Hear, which he labeled competently made curiosity. Wow. And then a rewatch, the Peerless 1940 film version of The Grapes of Wrath. So thank you, Eric. Over on Twitter, Lou writes, The Wandering Earth and Stuber, plus a bunch of hashtag streaming theater. That's what Lou Harry does. Emily Wheeler writes, His Girl Friday, Edge of Tomorrow, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the original, the Swedish version, The Half of It, Saving Face, What's Up Doc, and the original Shaft. Before I go to the Facebook portion of the list, I should read my list. And so, but at least started with a couple of couple ones that are not on Facebook. I mentioned last week that I watched Life of Pi, and I wanted to have one clarification. There was a tiger on the set for, I think, a day, and they shot as much as they could around that, and then they were able to CG in the rest. There's also seven shots of an actual hyena, and everything else is CG as far as animals, so there is that. So I just wanted to clarify that there was some tiger action, but not completely. Anyway, my midnight movie choice from last week, and part of it was because I read the title a couple of times last week, Baby Driver, which I had not watched, I think, since it opened, and a good rollicking time. I enjoy heist films. I've said before about the Edgar Wright films, Hot Fuzz, Shaun of the Dead, The World's End, is once I see that particular genre, I don't need to see it for another decade. I felt that way about Shaun of the Dead and to a certain degree of Hot Fuzz, but I do like heist films, but it's still enjoyable. Warner Archives put this out on Blu-ray last week because you need it on Blu-ray, but it was a great chance to revisit the at times batspit crazy, but not batspit crazy enough, the Southern melodrama Reflections in a Golden Eye from 1967. This is directed by John Huston and stars Marlon Brando, Elizabeth Taylor, Robert Forster's first film, Julie Harris, and Brian Keith. And in this, based on a controversial novel from the 40s, if I remember right, Brando plays an officer, a general in the army who's not having a great time with his wife. In fact, he has some odd feelings about a private in his army played by Robert Forster. This is the time by the late 60s that Elizabeth Taylor, anything she can do that resembles Martha for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, like screaming at her husband. And in this case, there's a scene where they're at a dinner party that they're throwing, and she starts whipping Brando in the face with a riding crop because she abused her horse. Now, a little background on the film. It didn't do well, although Roger Ebert gave it a rave review, and many consider it one of the low points in John Huston's film career. This video release is restored in Huston's original vision. It was originally shot with a completely muted color and golden tone, thus the title. And apparently a week, kind of like Cats, a week after the release, the studio imposed a full regular color treatment of the film. So there's that. But this is in its original golden version, so stay gold. it's not as crazy as some other Southern melodramas. And there was a great exchange I had with friends on Facebook about Southern melodrama or Southern gothic or just standard Southern dramas. I wish that video store was still around. And by the way, speaking of video stores, go to the Onions AV Club. There's a really nice essay about the death of the video store, and it reminded me of my year or so that I spent working at a crummy video store in Carroll Stream, Illinois. This was a place I was also working at a coffee shop at the time, trying to find writing work, and I didn't watch any movies that were new titles, which was expected of me. I went to what I called the center of the video store, the older titles. And it was also the time that Waterworld had come out, and my boss wondered why there was a boost in rentals of The Road Warrior, because I kept recommending that instead of Waterworld. Yeah, I'm a great employee. But I did wind up watching one film that had in the center that the tape was warped. And so I explained to my boss that I was watching old titles in the center to see the quality of the tapes. And she bought it. So anyway, and it was a fun to revisit that article and think about that. When working at a crummy video store in the 90s and your 20s was kind of a prerequisite. At least it was in my world. So anyway, Reflections in a Golden Eye is out on Blu-ray. Finally got to show our daughter Emma the 1999 film version of A Midsummer Night's Dream with Kevin Kline and Calissa Flockhart, Stanley Tucci, Michelle Pfeiffer. She enjoyed it as well as we always did. We always had. For Cinco de Mayo, I've revisited the film Rudo y Cursi. That's the one with Gael Garcia Bernal and Diego Luna. And the story of two brothers who are discovered by a football scout, although one goes up first. And this would be a good sports siblings double feature with a league of their own. There's also a very entertaining commentary with the filmmaker and the actors in character. But the ups and downs and how they both want famous football players, although Gael Garcia Bernal's character also wants to get into the music business. And sometimes blood is thicker than football. We also watched the Mike Birbiglia stand-up routine that was on, or it was one-man show, I should say, that's on Netflix. It covers everything from couches to birth. I found the Prime Video South by Southwest 2020 streaming series, and there's a couple of them called Cursed Films. One that talked about the Omen, and it talks about a couple incidents that happened during filming, and then stuff that happened after filming. So some of it you have to take with a certain grain of salt. And they also talked about Poltergeist, and there was a couple mishaps during the filming of Poltergeist, but it also later talked about the deaths of two of the actors, Heather O'Rourke as the young daughter, and Dominique Dunn, who was the older daughter, but she was beaten to death by her husband or boyfriend. Anyway, but it talks about some of the stuff that happens during filming and just bad things that involve the cast and crew after filming. So anyway, those are the titles I got to see. We now go to my Facebook page. Here's what you watched. Grab a pencil if you haven't already. Chris writes, The Friends of Eddie Coyle, which is a great crime drama starring Robert Mitchum. It is also on Criterion. Michelle writes, All Star Wars movies except the prequels. And Onward. Thank you, Michelle. Lisa writes, I watched Upload on Netflix, The Stand at Paxton County, and The Day Will Come. Ed writes, We bought The In-Laws on DVD, always wanted a physical copy. And Ed, you can get it on Criterion if you haven't got it on Criterion, and it's worth it. I mentioned Lou Harry, The Wandering Earth, and Stuber, plus a bunch of streaming theater. Linda writes, The Triplets of Belleville. Jared adds that he loves that one. In fact, this week in the AV Club, they did staff picks every day and this week the subject was films with very little or no dialogue in The Triplets of Belleville. There's a nice write-up on that film in the AV Club. Abby writes, The Avengers and Stardust. Kevin writes, Honey Boy was good. Joni Michaels. Hi, Joni. I got to get Joni on the show. Pale Rider, Unforgiven, Bridges of Madison County, a Clint week. That's pretty good. Stephen writes, Talk to Her, the 2001 BBC version of The Way We Live Now, National Theater's Frankenstein and their Antony and Cleopatra, Stratford Festival's Coriolanus. We tried to watch their King Lear, but appeared too genetic to stick with for almost 3 hours. Oh, too generic to stick with for almost 3 hours. And the Royal Ballet's version of The Winter's Tale. Thank you, Stephen. Rachel writes, Robin Hood, don't know which one, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Tomb Raider, Cradle of Life, and The Jungle Book. I'm also planning on watching The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug tonight, or Smaug. Jared writes, Endgame and Star Wars 1. Megan writes, Blow the Man Down and the Angelica Houston version of The Witches. Chris writes, Convoy. Yes. In fact, Nathan Raven's Happy Place a couple of weeks ago, but there's a fun essay about Convoy. Simon Majumder, who has been on this show, Gorky Park, Beastmaster, and The Conversation. And he's informed me that the Beastmaster has not aged well. And that doesn't surprise me. Justin writes, Code 8, Rise of Skywalker, and Becoming. Maria writes, Young Frankenstein. Wendell writes, Love, Can You Ever Forgive Me? And The Dancer Upstairs. Rosalie writes, The Perks of Being a Wallflower. And that's on my pile. I need to get to that. Thank you, Rosalie. Abby writes, Heathers, A Secret Love, Back to the Future, The Evil Dead, Circus of Books, and Underworld. Teresa writes, Stripes. Zachariah writes, Blood Simple, Raising Arizona, Summer 1993. Stephanie writes, Castaway. Jeff writes, I just finished At the Heart of Gold, a documentary about Larry Nassar and his abuse of female athletes. Scott writes, It was tearjerker week around here. All the Bright Places, Fault in Our Stars, and Beaches. Shannon writes, I had forgotten that Nine Inch Nails Every Day is Exactly the Same was in Wanted. Happy rediscovery. That's what happened, Shannon. Jennifer writes, This week I watched The Better Angels, a 2014 film about the boyhood of Lincoln, starring Jason Clarke and Diane Kruger. I discovered it while browsing Canopy. Very well done, little dialogue, and done in black and white. Thank you, Jennifer. Mary writes, North by Northwest. Mark writes, Spring Breakers and Donnie Darko. Joe Shearer, who's been on this show, he just posted me one of his photos from Letterboxd.com. Dr. Sleep, Fantasy Island, The Stand at Paxson County, Becoming, Extraction, Dangerous Lies, Fist of Fear, Touch of Death, ooh, Escape from Pretoria, and The Hunt. Thank you, Joe. Taylor writes, Curtiz, I need to get on that. That's a documentary about filmmaker Michael Curtiz. Gilda, that thing she does with her hair. Tomorrow Never Dies, Hail Caesar, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, and I have the original miniseries on my Blu-ray pile. I need to get to that. Hugo, Thor, Dogma, Sherlock Holmes and the Secret Weapon, Run Silent, Run Deep, Miss Fisher, and The Crypt of Tears. Thank you, Taylor. Michaela writes, The Half of It on Netflix. Amy writes, I recently watched The Peanut Butter Falcon again, and it was even better the second time around. Great feel-good movie. Barry writes, We caught the silent era of The Dragon Painter on TCM. Fascinating and evincing some of the ethnic casting issues that persist today. Yes, that is true. Bill writes, Finally introduced my significant other to a favorite of mine she had never seen. Lucas from 1986. If you can put aside the tragic and sordid off-screen drama associated with it, now you're going to look it up. It's a beautiful coming-of-age story. Forgive the cliche. I knew very little about it in advance, but I remember thinking I'd never before seen a story with characters of this age group who felt like real kids to me then, instead of young stand-up comics. Hi, John Hughes. Still interesting to see Winona Ryder, Jeremy Piven, and Courtney Thorne Smith in small early roles too, plus Gary Cole in a bit part. Thank you, Bill. Leslie writes Band of Brothers and Caddyshack. Grace writes The Social Network. Tony writes Impact, Reservoir Dogs, and Boyhood. Lucinda writes Django Unchained, The 2015 Cinderella, and Iron Man. David writes Motherless Brooklyn, Dante's Peak, a family favorite, and Secretariat. Oh, and Star Wars, A New Hope. Cheryl writes Bad Education on HBO. I need to get to that as well. Diana writes Tao, finishing the Ozark series, Dangerous Lies, and Lavender. Susan writes, I'm watching the original Frankenstein starring Anna Lowenin's nephew, Henry Pratt, a.k.a. Boris Karloff. And in the credits, the author was listed as Mrs. Percy Shelley instead of Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley. Ah, progress. Sorry, Susan, I know. Nancy writes, Jaws. And she put in 3 exclamation points. Britt writes, I tried to pick titles based on your post, my post. I'm introducing Anastasia to Shakespeare, starting off with Romeo e Juliet, or Romeo plus Juliet, that's Baz Luhrmann's version. Totally not what she thought it would be, and I sent her to bed with an emotional wreck. She loved it. She also added Ocean's 8, The Mummy, Tomb of the Dragon Emperor, The Scorpion King, I Am Divine, cracked up the Daryl Hammond story, and The Beastmaster. That's 2 Beastmasters this week, folks. Matthew writes, Mud, The Magnificent Seven, and Monuments Men. Daniel writes, Magic in Moonlight, Here Come the Girls with Bob Hope, Bell Book and Candle, The Love Witch, hi Jeff Parise, The Forbidden Street, Desire, Marlena Dietrich and Gary Cooper, North by Northwest, Sorry Wrong Number, and From Time to Time. Michelle writes, Ford versus Ferrari. As I always say about Ford versus Ferrari, Christian Bale screaming and yelling while driving is one of my favorite film moments from last year. Molly writes, Baby Driver. Scott writes, Molly's Game for Jessica Chastain. I understand. Jared writes, The Other Guys, Spencer Confidential, and Austin Powers. Tony writes, Groundhog Day, Beat the Devil, and The Man with the Golden Arm. And Justin writes, Train to Busan, Rogue One, and Extraction. And there we go, folks. There's plenty of titles out there. So hopefully this inspires you to check out some films you've either never seen before or you haven't seen in a long time and you want to revisit. So stay healthy, stay sane, and stay safe. Friends, some words to live by.
Silent Breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. We'll end this week's show going back to the reissue of the Errol Garner album, Now Playing. This is the great jazz piano player. And it's a Night at the Movies as a part. This was re-released by Mack Avenue Music Group as well as Octave Music. But movie music songs. And here's Errol Garner doing It's Only a Paper Moon for you Peter Bogdanovich fans out there. And it's been in other movies, I know. Anyway, you're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!